Hello, my name is Dr. Jim Doty, and I'm the host of the Into the Magic Shop podcast, where we explore the mysteries of the brain and the secrets of the heart. Welcome to the Into the Magic Shop podcast. My next guest is Jennifer Nadell, not only a transformational leader, but an award-winning journalist and best-selling author. She's also a qualified barrister and a political and communication strategist and commentator. As a journalist, she reported from around the world for the BBC, Channel 4 News, and ITN. As ITN's Home Affairs editor, she was one of the UK's most senior female television correspondents and was a renowned investigative journalist. She's also the founder of Compassion in Politics, a think tank in the United Kingdom, and is the executive chair of the Global Compassion Coalition. I hope you enjoy our conversation today. Jennifer, it's nice to see you again. Welcome to the show. And one of the things I do with all of my guests is actually ask them about their backstory, because as you know, almost all of us are a product of our backstory, how we grew up, what influenced us, and also, in some ways, sadly, the baggage we carry that drives us in different ways, sometimes for good and some not so good. So maybe you can give us a little bit about your background. One thing I am aware of is your father came to the UK on the Kinder transport. Is that correct?
That's correct. My father was a child refugee from Austria. He was Jewish, and at the age of 14, he caught a train in the middle of the night and came to the UK, where he knew nobody, and a family of strangers took him in. So if that hadn't happened, I wouldn't be here today talking to you. So I literally owe my life to compassion.
What happened to his family?
I don't know what happened to all of his family, but his immediate family did manage to escape through various tortuous routes. But what's interesting is that I never knew my father's story. I didn't know that he was Jewish. I didn't know that he was a refugee. I grew up thinking he was an American academic. He taught at Harvard and then at Princeton and then came over to the UK, which is why I have this accent. And he never ever talked about his past. And we would ask him questions, tell us about when you're little. And he would tell us it's very rude to ask questions. Why am I having this inquisition? So we knew literally nothing about his story. But even without knowing about his story, we still internalized it and lived with many of the symptoms. And as you know, there's a lot of research now on the epigenetic effect of being the next generation down from Holocaust survivors. And so I have many of those traits without ever having any conscious knowledge of that during my formative years.
So when did you ultimately find out his backstory? And also, did your mother know the backstory?
No, nobody knew. My mother came from, while my father was a refugee, my mother came from a WASPy East Coast family who, when she announced at the age of 18 that she wanted to get married to someone that no one had ever heard of, they set private detectives on my father to try and work out who he was and where he came from. And no one found out the truth about his origins. They just knew he was a brilliant PhD student. And so I found out really by accident shortly before he died. He had advanced Parkinson's by then and he couldn't speak, but he gestured to indicate that he had been part of that huge migration and the huge suffering that happened, you know, as the Second World War broke out.
Wow. Well, that's fascinating in that sort of a whole life of mystery. Why do you think he did not want to say anything?
He often talked about, you know, the phrase of Santayana, those who do not learn from their history are doomed to relive it. And he hadn't been a practicing Jew. He'd been culturally Jewish and he was an evangelical atheist. And I think the whole idea that he could be persecuted and that millions of people could be persecuted for a faith was such anathema to him that he thought it was better that we didn't know, and if we didn't know, then we would be safe should history repeat itself. And of course, you know, I discovered I was full of the nonsense of that and how he'd robbed me of knowing what my true story was, and I'd lost the opportunity to talk to him about it. But now, as the world turns once again towards darkness and the rise of extremism, I see that we're not safe as Jewish descendants. You know, there is no such thing as safety when the cogs of history are turning in the way that they are at the moment.
So you mentioned compassion, and that's an amazing story. How does that relate to the rest of your journey? I mean, becoming politically active, ultimately becoming a barrister, a broadcaster, journalist, an author, et cetera. What's the intertwining aspect of that drives you in that direction?
I really wasn't conscious of it for a long time. I just knew from my mid-teens that I had this drive to try and make things better, you know, and I ran my first protest when I was in my mid-teens, standing beside a road holding up placards. Didn't make any difference to the outcome of the road I was trying to stop being built through a green meadow. But what it taught me was that when I took action, when I tried to intervene, when I tried to do something to make things better, I no longer felt powerless and lacking in agency. And that experience really propelled me into a life of trying to find what levers I could pull to try and make the world better. And I started off thinking, well, if I'm a lawyer, then I can help change the laws. But of course, you know, it takes 20 or 30 years to get to the highest court, if you get to the highest court. And I was impatient and I was young. So then I went into journalism, and that was really satisfying. You know, I did manage to make some changes, and I did write a book that led to a change for women experiencing domestic violence, and I did help get other wrongly imprisoned people out of jail and, you know, create shifts in policy. But ultimately, I came to see that the way that the media worked, I was also creating harm while I was trying to do good. I was, you know, pointing the finger at the police officer who had helped to wrongly convict the innocently imprisoned person. But that police officer was themselves subject to pressures, and they themselves had a partner and children and parents. And, you know, I just became increasingly uncomfortable about this binary idea of half, you know, someone's either good or bad, and that it was okay for me to point my finger, because I realized when I pointed my finger, I caused harm. And if my goal was to reduce harm, then how, in the pursuit of that goal, could I justify causing harm? I don't know if that makes any sense, Jim.
No, I think it makes perfect sense. What a lot of people don't appreciate is that everybody has their backstory, everybody's suffering. And, you know, we make assumptions or presumptions about their actions, and they could be far, far off the mark. And so it really is hard to really know truth or the perception of what is truth in another person's mind, which, as you say, can result in much harm to them. So I
absolutely
think it makes...
And we're kind of brought up in this world culturally, aren't we, of goodies and baddies. You know, there's heaven, there's hell, there's the guy in the white cowboy hat and the guy in the black cowboy hat, and somehow we're always looking for friend or foe in this binary division, and we don't realize that actually we're all the same. We're all just struggling with our own internal wiring, and, as you say, our backstory. So the moment we enter that dividing up, that sorting of humans that society wants us to do so that we create others, we become part of the problem.
No, I think that's exactly right. And that's why it's also fascinating, because oftentimes we are quick to judge the actions of another country, and we put it through a very, very biased lens, let's say in the US or perhaps the UK, where we have some, especially in the U.S., this idea of our exceptionalism, when in fact, if you look closely, the U.S. has been guilty of a variety of crimes towards other countries, and including assassinating democratically elected politicians, or resulting in the downfall of a variety of countries who, in our country's opinion, are acting in a way that is a threat to us. And one of those, of course, is this longstanding us against them regarding communism. And again, not to debate those different philosophies per se, it's just to point out that no one's hands are clean.
Absolutely. No, the moment you point your finger, you have those other fingers pointing back at you. Yeah, we're all complicit to a greater or lesser extent, and political expediency can be the justification that's used for a whole series of wrongs. But of course, what are you ultimately defending if you're defending a nation by perpetrating the very wrongs that you're seeking to defend it from? There's a huge ethical and moral bankruptcy at the center.
Well, I think we're seeing some of this in the recent conflict in Israel and with the Palestinians. I think we also have continued similar events in this idea of an us against them, whether it's in Yemen or in Syria or in South Sudan or a variety of other places in the world, which sort of begs the question, why is that the case? I recently did a podcast with Paul Gilbert, who I think you know, the founder of Compassion Focused Therapy, and his assessment are humans are incredibly mean, horrible people, which I suppose is true.
It's kind of true, but it's kind of, you know, we have the capacity to be either inside of us, and it's what's cultivated, what's encouraged, what's nurtured, what's rewarded. And in society at the moment, you know, what's encouraged and rewarded is, you know, coming first, the me first, individualized, competitive self-interest that led to the hollowing out of the very things that actually keep us secure in society and give us a life of connection and value. So I know Paul's theory, and I just don't buy it. I think we can go in either direction. And I think that once we've gone into the nasty, brutish direction, we can return from it. I absolutely believe that all of us can return to center, and that when we're in center, you know, our natural state of alignment is one of love. But the moment we're threatened or triggered, we step out of that into egoic defenses, either attack or fawning or dissembling or whatever it is. But if we can just somehow learn, and I know this is a huge part of your work, how to step back into our true selves, that place of peace that we can cultivate and that exists, can exist within each of us, then we can be extraordinary.
Well, I think part of it, and one of the things he and I were discussing, was sort of overcoming your biologic imperative. And you know,
okay, I just want to take issue about that because you know, if you look at Darwin, and we're told it's the survival of the fittest, but I mean, first of all, Darwin didn't actually say that. And if you look at Darwin, he was actually saying it's those that can collaborate that survive most. So I think it's a slight misrepresentation, and you'll know the research which shows that when alphas are taken out of a group, the group then reforms in a non-hierarchical collaborative way to such an extent that when those alphas come back in, they are co-opted into the new system. So I think we're more sophisticated than that. And I think the only reason you exist and the only reason I exist is because we were nurtured and cared for, and that is our basic nature, just as much as the need to defend ourselves from any perceived attacks.
Well, I appreciate what you're saying. I certainly am familiar with Darwin's work and the articles you've quoted. But stepping back a little bit, you mentioned fear, and I think that is a big driver. And fear makes you do all sorts of bad things. And as a part of that, one of the things that we have evolved as humans is this tribal instinct. And I think that's where the real problem lies, because so many people, one, want to be accepted, and they find people who look like them, act like them. And as a result, it can result in horrible actions towards others. And in many ways, this is the objectification of an individual, right?
Absolutely. No, you're completely right. And all of that is available to us. But we also know that cultures can exacerbate that or diminish it. And there's been that wonderful research just coming out of Poland recently, which showed that anti-Semitism among narcissistic personality types could be toned down through a 60-day practice of gratitude. You know, we know from the science that we can tone down that tribal response. And that a lot of it is about psychological safety, because we become more tribal the more threatened we feel, the less safe we feel. So if we could actually create a society where we all felt taken care of, included, valued, seen, where our basic psychological needs were largely met, then that would tone down the fear response, which would tone down the tribalism, and which would enable us to expand our moral circle, our circle of concern.
Well, I think there are a couple aspects to that. One is the narcissistic behavior or the social dominance orientation of a subgroup of people, unfortunately, often is used to manipulate others to create a fear state when, one, there shouldn't be. And I think that's one of the problems. And maybe you can also comment on two other issues. One is this seemingly absolute imperative of the more right-leaning group that somehow by removing a social safety net, that's a good thing. And then the other is this idea, it's not an idea, the reality of ever-increasing income inequality.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we do know from research that the higher the fear levels an individual, the more likely they are to be conservative and right-wing. So a lot of those views are in themselves exacerbated by fear. And we know also that those who tend to be on the left are much more expansive, have a much more expansive, generous mindset, and are likely to experience less threat. So there's something in there about the levels of psychological safety a culture provides. But there's also something in there, you know, going back to what we were talking about with Paul Gilbert, you know, we all have within us the potential. And, you know, what's happening in the world is a macrocosm for what happens within each of us. You know, we all have our own struggle with our greed, our longing for status, our lust, our avarice, our envy, and our jealousy. And the safer we feel, the more those things diminish. So if we put people in a threatened state, then they are going to want to restrict. They're not going to want to share. They're going to perceive that safety is about just hanging on to what they've got and not giving it to anyone else. Hence, you know, the right-wing ideology that we don't give to other people. But it's, you know, it's what we nourish grows. And if we nourish a scarcity mindset, if we nourish a fearful and look at the messages we get politically, you know, the more that fear is cultivated, the more that restricted mindset gains dominance. And the more we see people doing something that's completely counterproductive. If you say, we know that if you want to live in a happy, safe, healthy society, income inequality has to be reduced. And that those societies which have the most equal level of resources are the ones that have the lowest crime rates and the best health outcomes. We know that. We absolutely know that.
Well, we simply need to look at many of the Nordic countries and other countries who believe in that philosophy. I mean, you look at Norway as an example. I mean, they're closing prisons down, yet in the United States and other countries, the prison population is increasing. And, you know, we go ahead.
I was just going to say there's something, you know, you talked about backstory, and it's so important because, you know, we all carry within us these wounded children. And, you know, if we don't have the psychological awareness or we haven't done the spiritual work, then those wounded children often get behind the steering wheel and determine our course of direction. So in societies where, you know, there's been fantastic education and levels of psychological safety, we see people in that expansive state. But in others, often we see this regressive state, or that's mine, or don't touch it, it belongs to me. And it's about some kind of regressed state that many of us end up living in because of that unprocessed childhood damage. And then, of course, feeding into that, sorry, I'll stop talking in a moment, but then feeding into that is our addiction to rightness. You know, because if we're feeling threatened and we get angry, that makes us feel energized, that makes us feel powerful, that makes us feel like we're going to end up on top. And into that pour hate, judgment, righteousness, and we have a really, really toxic cocktail. And I think there is a huge problem, not just on the right, but also on the left, with our addiction to rightness. Because once you think you're right, it justifies you behaving in undesirable ways to the other. You other in the same way as those who don't want migration other. Those who think they're right, even on the left, are othering those they think that are wrong. And we have to move beyond that binary. We have to move to a place where we can stretch across, put down the sword of righteousness, and move to a place where we really do see the humanity in all. As you know, as Rumi said, out beyond talk of right and wrongdoing, there is a field, I will meet you there. And I think more than ever at this moment, we need to reach beyond right and wrong to find that place where we've put down those weapons and we can just communicate heart to heart, human to human.
Well, it's sort of interesting that we've watched over the last, at least in the United States, probably with the occurrence of initially the Tea Party, that it has become absolute opposition and dismissiveness of the other's point of view, which of course then there can be no compromise or going to that field where there's neither right nor wrong. And I think that's part of the problem. It's also interesting, I think, when you look at what's happening in a variety of different countries in terms of the rise of authoritarianism and this narrative that you're suffering, and frankly, often because of the party who says you're suffering, that it comes out that I can fix the problem, only I can fix the problem. And, you know, we're seeing this in Hungary, Italy, France, Israel, Germany, the Netherlands, Poland now. And why do you think so many people are susceptible to that narrative?
I think it's that longing. You know, we spoke a moment ago about the, you know, the child within each of us that wants our needs to be met. And when we're scared, you know, these figures that promise everything's going to be happy ever after. I mean, Trump saying, I just want peace. You know, how many people just want peace? I mean, what an attractive message that is. The fact that he has no idea how to achieve peace, and the reality is he will cause far more conflict than he does resolve them, doesn't matter. And that's part of the issue that we're facing right now, that we've moved beyond reason. We've moved beyond fact. We've moved beyond scientific evidence to this place where when we adopt a position or when we throw our lot in with one of those charismatic leaders, it doesn't matter what evidence you throw at the person who's thrown their lot in with them, because it becomes part of our identity, because we so want to belong. And with the advent of neoliberalism, many of the ways that we belonged got thrown aside. You know, we became units of consumption without our psychological needs being met.
Well, that's an interesting statement. It's sort of fascinating how that narrative, also that there always has to be an increase in consumption, when in fact, I think that's part of the problem, this ever-increasing promotion of consumerism or the narrative, which you'd mentioned earlier, of I want, I want, I want. And I think that's unfortunately a result oftentimes of the media. And as you probably know, if you look at what's happening, I think there are only five major media companies. They've all consolidated. And we've all seen that also with private equity. I mean, BlackRock and some of these others own large percentages of the major corporations in the world. And it seems as though there's a small group of people who, for their own self-interest, of course, which is wealth acquisition or accumulation, are pushing that narrative.
And there's a revolving door often between those in political power with those who are involved in those major media organizations or investment organizations. But of course, the whole house of cards is built on a faulty premise. It's the premise of infinite growth, you know, and that is how money is made, through selling us infinite consumption and infinite growth. But we also know, those of us who actually believe in science, that we cannot carry on like this, or we as a species will be facing extinction. So it's how do you bring, you know, the moral knowing that is in within all of us out, to the extent that it can actually intervene in those spaces where people have defended themselves and fortified themselves in castles of wealth from the knowing that ultimately we're all going to die, and that all of us will be affected by climate change, and that they're leaving the next generation with one huge catastrophe on their hands.
Well, yes, I mean, I totally agree with you. It's interesting. We have Davos, where you have, you know, thousands of private jets fly in to discuss the economies of the world and theoretically have self-decided that they are the determinants of how the rest of the world should function. And of course, anyone's whose self-interest is related to a decision they have to make always choose the side of their self-interest. It's interesting, and I'm paraphrasing, but Tolstoy had a quote that said, there is a man on your back who's choking you. He acknowledges he's on your back choking you, but at no time does he ever offer to get off your back and stop choking you. And I think that's how I sort of view the group at Davos. They're never going to do anything that potentially compromises their self-interest. I think the other thing that you pointed out regarding politicians is that we have allowed corporate interest and the wealthy to be able to invest in politics. And unfortunately, I think, as you well know, now, at least in the United States, the corporations are even writing the legislation, which they then give to the politician. You know, there was a study that was done by Princeton where they analyzed the process of how groups get what they want in the context of politics. And one of the realities was that if 99% of people either wanted or didn't want a type of legislation, so something very popular, the likelihood of it getting it through the legislative process is essentially zero. If you are a major corporation or a billionaire, the likelihood would be 60 to 90%. And if that same class of people did not want legislation passed by the majority of people, there was essentially 100% chance that legislation would not pass, which is a very sobering statistic.
It is. And, you know, we like to think that we're the model democracies and we go out fighting wars. We spend a lot of time, America does, the UK does, exporting democracy as if we have the model political systems. But our systems have become really corrupted in exactly the way you say, by extreme wealth, by lobbying, by lack of really clear boundaries. And, you know, as my work in my work in compassion in politics, I'm always struck by how the rules that most people have to live by just do not have an application at the moment in the political space. And that's one of the things that we really need to see change. You know, as Robert Frost said, good fences make good neighbours. We need really clear rules that are abided by. And we manage to have those rules in business, in finance, in medicine, in the classroom, in universities. And we need to have those same rules in politics, because a lot of it is frankly verging on the criminal. We have bribes, we have threats, and that is how, as you say, decisions are taken. And that's completely unacceptable. And it really feels as if we're at a crossroads at the moment. You know, this is old politics, and it has brought us to war, to the brink of catastrophe, climate-wise, income inequality-wise, and now we have peace in those nations which have known peace for a long time under threat. And we have to shift to a new operating system. We have to shift to a new politics which is based on principles, values, and compassion, equity, social justice.
No, I, again, totally agree with you. So let me ask you the question, and you're the founder of the organization Compassion in Politics. Obviously, what we've just been discussing is the origin of that. But two, what have you been able to do in that context? And has it been effective with the political class?
We've obviously picked a challenge, and when we launched this Compassion in Politics, most people thought that we were joking because it seemed such a ludicrous idea. Nice idea, but you've got to be kidding. We're never going to get compassion in politics. But we now have over 100 MPs across every political party in the UK working and engaging actively with us. And we have reforms happening. For example, Labour, which is likely to form the next government, has agreed that it will introduce an independent ethics commission and take up a number of our other proposals. We've introduced legislation which would make deliberate misrepresentation an offence, as the same way it is in most commercial settings. So we've introduced legislation on the floor of the House. We've got commitments from parties to bring about change. And then there are the individual things that are just wrong that we've managed to intervene on. You know, during the pandemic, the government launched an initiative to take all the homeless off the streets, but it did nothing for women who, largely women who were locked in violent relationships in their home. There was nowhere for them to go. So we worked with hotels to enable those women and children to go to a safe place. And the government failed to do that. But working with those who want more compassionate outcomes, we could do that. So we kind of intervene, you know, in those gaps. And we also intervene in, you know, setting up new rules and also the outcomes of policy.
You know, one of the sad things, I think, is there is a lot of conversation about homelessness and the fact that so many people are using drugs, et cetera. And, of course, the other aspect, which is, you know, we forget about homelessness, also includes women and their children who have been exposed to violence and are homeless as a result. But I would suggest that one aspect of that is actually the destruction of the middle class in the Midwest, if you will, where manufacturing was outsourced to frequently third world countries. This left a dearth of jobs available. And one of the highest suicide rates is among men in their 40s. And also, this has led to the opioid crisis, which, frankly, was driven in many ways by a corporate interest pushing pills, which they knew were harmful, all for profit. And in fact, you may not know this, but in medicine, during that period of time, legislation passed that if a patient came in and said they were in pain, we could not refuse them narcotics. And of course, that has now been reversed and has gone to the other extreme. But again, it shows what happens when you continually take away and people feel they have no choice, there's nothing for them, they have no future, and it creates this narrative of despair and hopelessness, which then, of course, for many men, leads to frustration, oftentimes violence, because they have no outlet and they have no future, and of course, also drug use. And then, of course, this leaves the family unit completely destroyed, which is also interesting, at least in the context of the right in the United States, which oftentimes, and I'm not quite sure how or why, has somehow wrapped itself around Christianity and nationalism.
Which is extraordinary when you compare what's actually said in the Bible with what some of the evangelical churches are preaching, the hate and the bile and the judgment, as opposed to the love that certainly was at the core of the New Testament. But everything is crackers. You know, we have built our house on the wrong foundations. We've built our house on the idea that material things can make us fulfilled and happy. We've been sold a pup. And then when that system starts to crumble, we have nothing to cling on to, and we're hurtling in emotional, psychological, spiritual pain, and we reach for whatever is going to deaden the pain. And so we need to look at how we organize. But the other thing is, you know, both of us are old enough to remember the dawning of the age of, you know, computers everywhere, and this idea that work was going to decrease, that we were all somehow going to share work out more equitably so that we'd all have leisure time, we'd do a 2 or 3 day, everyone would be happier. And of course, the opposite has happened. You know, many more people don't have work, and those that do have work are working far more longer hours in far more precarious positions. And, you know, as AI comes in, we have another moment in time where we can think about, well, how do we want to distribute the positive things that can come as a result of AI? You know, how can we use it to improve society for the good of all? And we should be looking at the working week. We should be looking at how we oblige ourselves to live. And, you know, for me as a woman, when I look at the lack of maternity legislation that you have in the States, when I look at the lack of worker protection, when I look at the levels of homelessness, when I look at the levels of hunger, which are all growing in the United Kingdom, but not anywhere near the level they are in the States, how can that happen? And it's all so twisted because no one feels good, whether we're conscious of the suffering that is happening as a result of our plenty and other people's lack. Whether we're conscious of it or not, we are all paying a price for it. It is not nice to walk down the street and see people without homes, without shelter, or who are hungry. It is not good to know that this suffering exists, and we all pay a psychological price. And some of us just pour concrete over our knowing and become judgmental and blame those who've fallen upon hard times as if it's somehow their fault that life has the dice have fallen as they've fallen. But actually, you know, if we could reduce the levels of suffering, all of us would be happier.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And it sort of begs the question, why is this happening? You've talked about, on the one hand, our innate nature to love, yet every aspect of what's happening in society is counter to that, it seems. And what I find fascinating, and I think you have sort of interacted in this realm, and I preface this by saying I acknowledge that I'm in the top 1%, but what I would say is the other, let's say the 0.001%, they will complain about this. And I'm not trying to make a broad judgment on everyone. It's certainly not the case. But a significant number of individuals in that class will make statements like that. Well, why are the streets dirty? Why don't we lock these people up? You know, this is their own problem. They created it. When in fact, the people speaking are the ones who created it. Who needs more than several million dollars? Who needs $280 billion? And the reality with these types of people is, unfortunately, that level of wealth gives them the ability to have access to every politician, to move the needle in areas that benefit them, with no interest in how the rest of the world function. And it's always through the lens of it's their own fault, when in fact it's not their own fault. And in fact, it's our responsibility to care for these individuals and create systems that are supportive. And whether that's in the context of feeding, housing, maternity leave, education, health care, if that narrative changed just a little bit, you could provide a real social safety net to, I think, everyone. And it's just extraordinary to me how so many people are blind to this reality.
Yeah, and I think there are two things at play in particular there. One of them is how we defend ourselves psychologically against the suffering of another. You know, if someone else is suffering, that's scary, it's messy, it has implications for who we are. You know, if we're the person who is whose exploitation of the other has led to conditions in which that person is so precarious that they can fall off the ledge into homelessness altogether, we don't want to know that. So we slip into denial, and it's far easier psychologically to blame someone for their misfortune than it is to think, oh my goodness, I've got to do something. And of course, we live in a culture that has encouraged that, where those in need have been demonized and portrayed as scroungers, as people trying to get something for nothing, people who don't want to work. So we have othered them. But that serves a psychological purpose, because it means that if it's their fault, we don't need to do anything. We don't even need to feel bad about it, because it's their fault. They could make themselves better. They just need to pull themselves together. And that absolves us of the messy business of feeling human. So that's one part. The other part is, because of the legacy of communism, America in particular, but increasingly in many European countries, including the United Kingdom, we have an antipathy towards the state. You know, the state symbolizes this big controlling force that's going to rob us of our sovereignty. But actually, the reason we come together as a society is because together we can do better than individually. And the way we do that is by having a state that can distribute resources fairly, that can tackle social ills. And in America, of course, because of the antipathy towards the state and the horror that the state might actually make sure that everyone has health insurance or enough to eat or is housed, heavens, that would just be so dreadful that we had a state that would do those things. We open up the space for philanthropy, which is allowing those very wealthy people that you're talking about really to kind of at their whim decide who they want to give their money to, and then be praised for having been so generous, for having given the fortune that they built off the backs of the labor of others away. And of course, that's a capricious system, and it's a system that leads to funds being channeled to those causes that are pretty or easy to empathize with, rather than the causes that are most in need of resources. And tied within that is the whole notion of what is the purpose of politics? You know, if the purpose of politics isn't to protect citizens and to create an environment in which the majority, everyone, if possible, can thrive and have access to the conditions that are necessary to live a happy life. I mean, what else is the point of politics? Politics shouldn't be. It's become this binary system of tug of war over this policy or that policy. But politics should be about a collaborative effort to solve complex problems and to alleviate avoidable suffering. Life is full of suffering, but too much of it is avoidable, and too much of it does have solutions that just aren't being enacted because we have these horror of being controlled or having, you know, someone other than ourselves actually act on our behalf to do good.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I love people who will sit there and say, well, government should be run like a business. it shouldn't be run like a business. The goal isn't to maximally profit. The goal is to be of service, and you don't have to make money. You have to care. And I think it's always sort of fascinating that people would say that. And also, again, getting back to this reality that people create narratives that justify actually oftentimes horrible behavior. Well, as you know, the fear aspect of this, what is happening, is quite powerful. But let's talk about resilience. How in this environment can somebody be resilient? Can somebody actually understand, not let it destroy them, and still work for the common good?
Such an important question. And, you know, having worked in the in and around the political space for over three decades, I have seen what happens to people who are staring at the horrors that are happening in this world without paying attention to their own resilience. And what happens is they become part of the problem. They start thinking whatever they do is justified because they're right. And so I personally think that we have to have an awareness of our own psychological process. We have to have an awareness of how to practice self-compassion, how to take care of ourselves. You know, Audre Lorde says that self-care is an act of political preservation. And it's so easy for us to dismiss it as a bit new age, a bit hippy-dippy, a bit, you know, woo-woo, or just not important in the face of suffering. But if we're not resilient, not only do we risk burning out, we also risk co-opting other people's suffering to fit into an unmet psychological need that we have. You know, I want to feel important, so I'm going to show that I'm doing the most for these poor suffering people. And when these poor suffering people don't act in the way that I need them to act so that I can look like the savior, I'm then going to turn on them. And this happens again and again and again. You know, it's like the person who jumps into the water to save someone who's drowning but doesn't know how to swim themselves. They become part of the problem. So, you know, for myself and the training that I do with those in the political space, it is all about how do we come back to center? How do we become aware of our own personal damage and how it plays out and how we might act it out? How do we take care of ourselves when we're triggered? How do we learn to recognize when we're triggered, when we're in fear or egoic defenses? And how can we nourish and nurture yourselves? And one of the things that I think we ignore as a society, and particularly those who are involved in you know, trying to make the world better, is, you know, the three-letter word joy. You know, it's so small, but for me, joy is the oxygen that enables our pilot light to really glow, and we ignore joy at our peril. And joy is something that happens when we create the space for it. It happens when we walk down a street and notice what the sky is doing, or we notice the flower that's bravely poking its way between two paving stones, or we connect with the eyes of the barista or the person who's selling papers at the station, you know, and that joy costs nothing. And when we allow ourselves to experience it, we snap back into our aligned selves, and we can become beacons of hope and love.
No, I think that's a very, very important point. And also this idea that people forget sometimes, that every one of us has the capacity to improve the life of another person. And sometimes it's just a smile, sometimes it's saying hello, or doing an act that, again, as you point out, costs absolutely nothing. And I think on those two notes, our time has run out, but I certainly appreciate you and the work you're doing. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Anne, for all that you do.
Again, thank you for being with us today. The Into the Magic Shop podcast can be found where you find your most popular podcasts, or you can find us at intothemagicshop.com.